September 4th, 1993. Plano, Texas. While attending a soccer game at a park with her family, 7-year-old Ashley Estelle goes missing. The following day, Ashley is found strangled to death next to a dirt road. The investigation soon leads to a paroled sex offender named Michael Blair, who is subsequently convicted of Ashley's murder and sentenced to death. However, the evidence against Blair turns out to be faulty, and DNA testing eventually exonerates him of the crime, but Ashley's real killer is never found. After that, the trail went cold. Hello everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host Robin Warder, and today we're going to be exploring a brutal crime which led to all sorts of controversy. The 1993 murder of 7-year-old Ashley Estelle. This case was originally suggested to me a while back by a listener named Jamin, and only a few weeks later, another listener named Leslie sent in a request to cover it, so I thought it deserved a look. A suspect named Michael Blair would be convicted and sentenced to death for Ashley's murder, and since he was a convicted sex offender who had been paroled after serving less than 2 years, this led to the passing of some new legislation called Ashley's Laws, which sought stronger punishment for criminals who harmed children. But in an ironic twist, it would later turn out this legislation was based around a wrongful conviction, as the man sent to death row for Ashley Estelle's murder wound up getting exonerated via DNA testing. Now, even though he did not actually kill Ashley, Michael Blair was most definitely a dangerous sex offender who deserved to be locked up, but this story is a case study on the dangers of tunnel vision, as law enforcement was so convinced of his guilt that they may have ignored other potential leads. As a result, the real killer of Ashley Estelle has never faced justice, so in this episode, we're going to explore how things went horribly wrong in this case. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play Music, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now delve into the unsolved murder of Ashley Estelle. Our story begins in 1993 in Plano, Texas, a large suburb located 20 miles north of downtown Dallas. Our central figure is 7-year-old Ashley Nicole Estelle, who lives with her parents, Dick and Diana Estelle, and her 12-year-old brother, Brett. Ashley was originally born in Des Moines, Iowa, before the family moved to Texas in 1988. On Saturday, September 4th, which happened to be Labor Day weekend, the Estelle family went to Carpenter Park for a soccer tournament, as Brett would be playing in one of the games. At around 11:20 a.m., while her parents were watching the game, Ashley went off alone to play on the swing set of a playground located a few yards away from the field. Her family soon noticed that Ashley was no longer there, and after being unable to find her, they reported Ashley missing at 12:15 p.m. Even though a large crowd of over 1,000 people were in the park to watch the tournament, it seemed like Ashley had vanished without anybody seeing anything. As a result, a massive search effort was launched to find Ashley, which involved law enforcement and thousands of volunteers. Well, there would be tragic news at around noon the following day, when Ashley's body was discovered in a ditch next to an isolated dirt road located 6 miles from Carpenter Park. Even though police never publicly disclosed if Ashley had been sexually assaulted, her body was partially clothed. The cause of death was determined to be strangulation with a rope or wire. Since Ashley's own fingernail marks were found on her neck, it seemed likely she had struggled and made an attempt to free herself from the item used to strangle her. The crime had a devastating impact on the community, as Plano was known for having the lowest crime rate in the state. But it wasn't long before investigators turned up a promising suspect. On September 10th, some evidence technicians from the Plano Police Department were doing some work at the location where Ashley's body was found when they happened to notice a vehicle driving through the area, which passed by the scene several times. They finally decided to follow the vehicle and pull it over for a traffic stop. The driver turned out to be Michael Blair, a 23-year-old carpet cleaner who was originally born in Thailand and had a criminal record. In November of 1988, Blair had broken into a Dallas apartment and attempted to sexually assault an 11-year-old girl while she was sleeping, but fled the scene after she put up a struggle. Well, 1 week later, he actually returned to the same apartment, and this time, he attempted to kidnap the same girl by reaching in through the bedroom window and trying to pull her out of bed. Blair wound up receiving a 10-year prison sentence for burglary and indecency with a child, but was paroled in 1990 after serving only 18 months. Anyway, Blair instantly captured the attention of the police during his traffic stop, as he had a flyer and newspaper clipping about Ashley's case in his vehicle. Blair claimed that he had volunteered to participate in the search for Ashley on the morning of September 5th. He said he had a fascination with cases in which children went missing or were murdered, which is why he felt compelled to visit the location where Ashley's body was found. Blair was subsequently taken to the police station for questioning. He gave them consent to search his vehicle, and some of the items they found included a stuffed toy bunny, a knife, a blanket, and 3 hairs. Blair was interrogated for 10 hours, but denied any involvement in Ashley's murder. Since there was no evidence to implicate him at this point, Blair was eventually allowed to leave, though the police kept him under 24-hour surveillance and started building a case against him. At the time, Blair was sharing an apartment with his boss, but he wound up being kicked out for unknown reasons, so he moved into a motel. On September 14th, investigators showed up at Blair's motel room door, where he was arrested and charged with capital murder. It was announced that hair and fiber evidence were used to link Blair to the crime. If convicted, Blair would face the death penalty, so he was offered a deal by the state in which he could plead guilty and be sentenced to life imprisonment. Well, Blair maintained his innocence and turned the deal down. Due to the massive publicity surrounding the case, the trial would have to be moved to the city of Midland, 5 hours away. It finally began in September of 1994, and was prosecuted by the Collin County District Attorney's Office. They produced numerous experts who would testify about the hair and fiber evidence, including a forensic analyst named Charles Lynch. Lynch testified that the 3 hairs which had been found in Blair's car had the, quote-unquote, same microscopic characteristics as Ashley's hair. In addition, 2 hairs had been found on Ashley's body, and Lynch described them as being of, quote-unquote, mongoloid racial origin, which seemed consistent with Blair since he was born in Thailand. A connection was also made between the fibers on the stuffed bunny from Blair's vehicle and some fibers from Ashley's body, which were described as only having, quote-unquote, subtle differences. But it's worth noting that all the expert testimony was carefully worded, as no one explicitly stated that the hair or fiber evidence was a positive match. There was also controversy over a clump of hairs which were entered into evidence, as they had been found during a search of Jack Carter Park, which was located 2 miles away from Carpenter Park. Once again, there was expert testimony that the clump of hairs was microscopically similar to hairs belonging to both Blair and Ashley, but the defense argued that these hairs were irrelevant, since there was no evidence that either the defendant or the victim had ever been in Jack Carter Park to begin with. The prosecution also produced 3 eyewitnesses who testified that they had seen Blair in Carpenter Park on the day Ashley went missing. However, the defense questioned the reliability of their testimony, as none of the witnesses were asked to identify Blair from a photo lineup until after he was publicly named as the prime suspect. In fact, 2 of the witnesses admitted, that they had already seen Blair's photo on television beforehand. And even though these witnesses claimed they saw Blair in Carpenter Park, the state was unable to produce anyone who saw him together with Ashley. Blair's alibi was that he was sleeping inside his apartment during the time period Ashley was abducted. Blair and his roommate, who also happened to be his employer, had both spent the entire night doing a carpet cleaning job, and they did not arrive home until 6 a.m. The roommate claimed that his ex-wife showed up at the apartment to drop off their kids, and that when they left together at around 10:30 a.m., Blair was sleeping on the couch. By the time they returned at 4:30 p.m., he claimed that Blair was still asleep. While this did not prove that Blair couldn't have committed the crime, a forensic pathologist testified that based on the decomposition on Ashley's body, he believed that the perpetrator kept her somewhere else overnight and did not dump her body by the road until the morning she was found. The defense attempted to point the finger at an alternate suspect named Josh Crowley, who had been refereeing the soccer games at Carpenter Park on the day Ashley was abducted. Like Blair, Crowley was a sex offender who had fled to Texas because he was facing a potential 10-year prison sentence for pending child molestation charges in South Carolina. Crowley was briefly questioned by police, but left town immediately thereafter and did not even bother picking up his last paycheck. Once Blair entered the picture, investigators dismissed Crowley as a suspect, as his previous sexual indiscretions were with boys, not girls. By the time Blair's trial started, Crowley was serving time in a South Carolina prison, and when given a videotaped deposition about Ashley's murder, he answered every question by pleading the Fifth Amendment in order to avoid self-incrimination. As a result, the court denied the defense's request to call Crowley to the witness stand during the trial. The jury would end up viewing the videotapes of Blair's entire 10-hour interrogation by police, in which they discussed his extensive history of sexual abuse, which included him repeatedly raping his 6-year-old half-sister when he was 16 years old. While Blair never confessed to murdering Ashley, there was one point during the interrogation where he was asked if he was at Carpenter Park at the time Ashley was abducted, and he angrily cried out, quote, "I don't know if I was there. I just do not know," end quote. Blair would actually be called to the stand to testify in his own defense, and while he admitted to having molested preteen girls in the past, he denied having any involvement with Ashley's murder. During the state's closing argument, the prosecutor referred to Blair as a quote-unquote subterranean little troll, and it soon became clear that the jury pretty much felt the same way about him. On September 28, 1994, after deliberating for only 27 minutes, the jury found Blair guilty of capital murder. During the sentencing phase, numerous female witnesses would testify about Blair sexually harassing and assaulting them and making attempts to fondle young girls. In fact, Blair's ex-wife even testified that he had repeatedly raped her. The jury deliberated for 91 minutes before they decided to sentence Blair to death by a lethal injection. Before Blair's trial even started, the Texas Board of Pardons and Paroles had faced a major backlash over the fact that they had paroled him after he served only 18 months of a 10-year sentence. Their cover story was that the paperwork about Blair's charge for indecency with a child had been mistakenly admitted from his file when they received it, so they only knew about his burglary conviction when they decided to parole him. Well, no one really bought this story, and Ashley's parents even went so far as to sue the state for allowing Blair's release to happen. Overall, the message seemed clear that Ashley's murder could have been prevented and that the system needed some changes. As a result, Texas Senator Florence Shapiro, who resided in Plano, decided to push forward new legislation to provide harsher punishments for sexual predators. In 1995, Governor George W. Bush signed Ashley's Laws, a series of bills which mandated longer prison terms for sex offenders who harm children, as well as mandatory public registration for any offenders who were released from prison, so that local law enforcement could warn the community if predators like Michael Blair moved into their area. While it seemed like Ashley's legacy would live on with these new laws, this would not be the end of the story, as it would soon become apparent that the wrong person may have been convicted of her murder. Blair's death sentence eventually caught the attention of the Innocence Project, who agreed to take on his case. He was originally scheduled to be executed in July of 1999, but was granted a stay so that DNA testing could be performed on a number of pieces of forensic evidence. The test would be performed with more advanced technology, which was not available at the time of Blair's trial. There was a lot of concern about the credibility of forensic analyst Charles Lynch, whose testimony about the hair and fiber evidence helped convict Blair. It turned out that Lynch was suffering from alcoholism and depression at that time, and had voluntarily checked into a psychiatric hospital before the trial. In fact, the state had granted Lynch a temporary release from the hospital so he could testify, a piece of information which was not disclosed to Blair's defense team at the time. During this time period, Blair was corresponding with Jackie Hilburn, a journalist writing an article about his case for D Magazine, and brought up an interesting point which was not mentioned at his trial. One day, Hilburn opened up a letter from Blair and was shocked to discover that it contained a plastic packet with dozens of skin flakes. Blair claimed that he suffered from a skin affliction which caused him to frequently shed small flakes of dry skin. Nothing like this was found at Ashley's murder scene, and since the weather was brutally hot on the weekend she was abducted, wouldn't Blair's skin flakes have adhered themselves to Ashley's body if he had killed her? Well, even without this detail, it soon became apparent that the forensic evidence used to convict Blair was junk science. Even though the two hairs found on Ashley's body were believed to be Blair's, DNA testing excluded the hairs as belonging to him or Ashley. It also revealed that the three hairs found in Blair's vehicle did not belong to Ashley either. Further DNA testing was performed on some skin cells found underneath Ashley's fingernails. It wound up uncovering the DNA profiles of two separate males, and neither of them matched Blair. At first, the Collin County District Attorney's Office held the attitude that the DNA testing did not prove that Blair was innocent, but they ultimately decided to reopen the investigation in 2006 and assigned it to a cold case squad. Additional DNA testing was performed on Ashley's shirt, shoes, and the stuffed bunny from Blair's car. There was no male DNA found on the stuffed bunny, and while male DNA was found on the shirt, there was insufficient material to link it to anybody. But there was a sufficient amount of male DNA on each of Ashley's shoes, and once again, it did not match Blair. DNA samples were also taken from Josh Crowley, the soccer referee whom Blair's defense team believed was a strong alternate suspect. To their surprise, the DNA testing excluded Crowley as well. But in the end, the results finally convinced Collin County prosecutors to request that Blair's conviction be vacated. In August of 2008, a judge dismissed the murder charge against Blair, and he was finally removed from death row. However, this did not mean that Blair would get to walk out of prison. Remember how I mentioned that Blair had been corresponding with a journalist from D Magazine named Jackie Hilburn? She conducted her first interview with him in 1999, and while Blair continued to maintain that he did not kill Ashley Estelle, he did confess to having molested over a dozen other children, both girls and boys. Over the next few years, Blair would send Hilburn hundreds of letters, some of which contained detailed confessions to his many sexual offenses. Blair's victims were not strangers he selected at random, but rather children of friends and acquaintances whom he would befriend before he abused them. While the statute of limitations for most of these crimes had expired, Blair did confess to molesting three children in Dallas in 1992 and 1993, shortly before he was charged with Ashley's murder. When Blair detailed these crimes in a letter he sent to the Collin County District Attorney's Office, the Dallas County District Attorney's Office decided to charge him with four counts of aggravated sexual assault. In June of 2004, Blair agreed to plead guilty to these charges and received three consecutive life sentences, as well as a fourth life sentence to be served concurrently. So while being exonerated of Ashley Estelle's murder meant that Blair would not be executed, these other charges ensured that he would remain in prison for the rest of his life. In spite of this, Blair actually made a request for $1 million in compensation from the state for his wrongful conviction, but this request was denied by the Texas Supreme Court in 2013. Anyway, the new investigation by the Collin County District Attorney's Office seemed to point towards another suspect who was never looked at by police or mentioned at Blair's trial. However, this man has never been publicly identified, and was only referred to in court papers as Suspect Number 4. By the time Blair was exonerated, Suspect Number 4 had been deceased for a decade, but one of the most suspicious things which seemed to implicate him in the murder is that he specifically bought a cemetery plot for himself as close as possible to Ashley Estelle's grave, though it's unclear if he was actually buried in it after he died. He also joined the same church the Estelle family attended, and moved into an apartment near where Ashley had lived and gone to school. If that wasn't enough, he had also allegedly lied to people by telling them he had a child who was once abducted from a park, murdered, and dumped near a gravel road, which sounded similar to Ashley's murder. But the evidence to incriminate Suspect Number 4 was not conclusive, because while he cannot be excluded as the source of the male DNA found on Ashley's shoes, DNA testing did exclude him as being the contributor of the hair evidence and the skin under Ashley's fingernails. Investigators also could not uncover evidence to prove that Suspect Number 4 was in Carpenter Park, or the Plano area, on the day of the crime. The Collin County District Attorney stated, quote, "Unfortunately, despite strenuous efforts, the team has been unable to eliminate or conclusively connect this person to the offenses," end quote. Thus far, no plans have ever been made to exhume Suspect Number 4's body for any further testing. All anybody is certain about is that Michael Blair was not the perpetrator, and following his exoneration, Barry Schenck, the co-director of the Innocence Project, stated, quote, "In this case, the community rushed to judgment because Michael Blair had a record as a sex offender, while the apparent real perpetrator, who had no record, evaded justice. More than just an irony, this should give everyone pause about legislating or reaching court decisions based on community fear and outrage," end quote. As for Ashley Estelle, a book she had written in the months prior to her death, titled Just Perfect, was published in 2009 in order to honor her memory, and proceeds from the sales of the book were donated to the Children's Advocacy Center of Collin County, which serves as a sanctuary for abused and neglected children. But unfortunately, after more than 25 years, Ashley's horrific murder continues to remain an unsolved crime. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. Now, this is definitely one of the most complex wrongful conviction cases I've ever come across, and it's pretty remarkable to see how this story has evolved over the past 25 years. If you type Ashley Estelle's name into YouTube, you'll find a one-hour clip which is a compilation of local news segments which aired in the year following her murder, chronicling the investigation and arrest of Michael Blair, along with his subsequent trial and conviction. And if you were following the media coverage at that time, it would be really hard to imagine that Blair could possibly be innocent of this crime. There was zero doubt that Blair was a dangerous sexual predator who harmed children, and many of those aforementioned news segments put a heavy emphasis on the fact that he was sentenced to 10 years in prison for attempting to assault and abduct an 11-year-old girl, but wound up being paroled after serving only 18 months. This escalated into quite a scandal, as the Texas Board of Pardons and Paroles tried to do a lot of covering up to justify their decision, such as concocting a really lame story about how the paperwork about Blair's attack on the girl was mistakenly left out of his file at his parole hearing. Well, the fact of the matter is, Blair's early release was due largely to an epidemic of serious prison overcrowding which Texas experienced during the 1980s and early 90s. It reached the point where as many inmates as possible had to be paroled or receive an early release in order to fix this issue, and unfortunately, this meant that some dangerous criminals were allowed back out onto the streets and wound up reoffending. So you can imagine the outrage when everyone believed that Blair murdered Ashley Estelle when he should have been behind bars serving a 10-year sentence. As I mentioned in the episode, this whole controversy led to the passing of Ashley's laws, which ensured that sex offenders who harm children would receive harsher sentences, lesser chances of parole, and mandatory sex offender registration if they did get released. Now, even though he did not actually kill Ashley, We know that Blair did molest some children after he was paroled, so that decision still had negative consequences. Those who championed Ashley's laws do not believe that Blair's exoneration in the murder case made the legislation any worthwhile, and that is true, though it's pretty ironic that these laws stem from a case which turned out to be a wrongful conviction. So there's really no other way to say this. Michael Blair is a sick human being, and he most definitely deserves to be incarcerated for the rest of his life. This isn't like most other wrongful conviction cases, as there was no emotional scene where an innocent person walked out of prison to experience freedom for the first time in years. Even though his death sentence was overturned, ensuring that he would not be executed for murder, Blair had since received multiple life sentences for molesting other children, so the only change was that he was transferred from death row to the prison's general population. I know everyone was pretty insulted when Blair asked for $1 million in compensation for his wrongful conviction. A few years earlier, Texas had passed a bill called the Tim Cole Act, named after a young man who was wrongly convicted of rape and died in prison before his family used DNA testing to exonerate him and earn him a posthumous pardon. The Tim Cole Act ensured that anyone who was wrongly convicted of a crime would receive $160,000 for each year of incarceration, but Cole's brother publicly stated that awarding that type of compensation to Blair, who was guilty of a number of other terrible crimes, would soil his brother's name and memory. It's a valid point, since that money is supposed to help wrongly convicted people readjust to society, and there's no reason a child molester who's going to remain locked up for the rest of his life needs $1 million, which is why his request was ultimately rejected. It's hard to understand what Blair's motivation might have been when he decided to confess to molesting all these other children while he was on death row. Perhaps he felt there was no way his death sentence was going to be overturned, and just wanted to clear his conscience before he was executed. I do not want to go into explicit detail about Blair's crimes on this episode, but if you want to learn more information, go check out the article published in D Magazine by Jackie Hilburn in 2001. She interviewed Blair, and had to read all those letters he sent her, in which he described all his abuse against children in graphic detail, and being a mother herself, this made Hilburn physically ill. It's definitely a good thing that Blair wound up being convicted of additional crimes while he was on death row, because if he had walked out of prison after his murder conviction was overturned, I think it's a guarantee he would have attempted to harm more children, because it looks like he's one of those serial predators who just cannot stop. In most cases, I would be pretty aghast at the idea that the jury at his murder trial only took 27 minutes to find him guilty, but I can kind of understand it here. At the time, they wouldn't have known that the physical evidence against him was junk science, and that there were major credibility issues with Charles Lynch, the forensic analyst who testified against him. And even though Blair denied being a murderer, the trial did not shy away from some of his other heinous crimes, which included raping his 6-year-old half-sister when he was a teenager. So I can definitely see why a jury would believe he was more than capable of killing Ashley. It's no secret that Texas is the most pro-death penalty state there is, and has sent a number of people to death row who turned out to be innocent, but that doesn't necessarily mean all those exonerees were good people. You might recall the episode I did last year about the unidentified female murder victim known only as Orange Socks. Notorious serial killer Henry Lee Lucas was sentenced to death for a murder after confessing to it, but the sentence was later commuted to life imprisonment, because the evidence clearly showed that Lucas was in an entirely different state at the time the crime took place. Like Michael Blair, Lucas was a vile individual who was guilty of other crimes and deserved to be locked up. But no matter what your views on the death penalty might be, if you execute these monsters for the crimes they did not actually commit, that allows the real killer to get away with it. So let's go back to the beginning and see how this crime unfolded. Another episode I did last year, which you might remember, was the disappearance of Michael Dunahy, a 4-year-old boy who vanished from a school playground in British Columbia in 1991. You can see a number of parallels with what happened to Ashley Estelle. In both cases, the parents took their child to a sporting event at a public place and let them out of their sight for a few minutes so they could go visit a playground. Even though there were a ton of people in the vicinity, an unknown perpetrator somehow managed to abduct the child and flee the area without anyone seeing anything. Both these stories are pretty much every parent's worst nightmare and show just how easily something horrible like this could happen. In Ashley's case, there were literally over 1,000 people in Carpenter Park, and I know that some of them were filming the soccer games, prompting law enforcement to extensively study their video footage to see if they captured anything which could provide clues about Ashley's abduction. One of the biggest points made in Michael Blair's defense is that there were no witnesses who could place him and Ashley together that day, but then again, there were no witnesses who could place Ashley with anyone else who might have abducted her. Now, while there are some wrongful conviction cases where it's obvious the authorities knew they were railroading an innocent person, I have no problem believing that the authorities in this case genuinely believed that Michael Blair was the right guy. Even putting aside his past record for crimes against children, he first showed up on the police's radar by driving by the murder scene several times. He had a flyer for Ashley's disappearance in his vehicle and a stuffed bunny, which totally fits the profile of a sexual predator using toys to lure children. Blair's alibi on the day of the crime was that he was sleeping in his apartment, and there was a period of several hours when no other eyewitnesses could account for his whereabouts. Blair's roommate did verify that he returned home and found Blair sleeping at 4:30 p.m., and while the time frame for Blair to have murdered Ashley and made it back to the apartment by 4:30 would have been tight, it was not impossible. Since forensic science was nowhere near as advanced back then as it is today, I'm sure it was easy to believe that Charles Lynch's testimony about the hair and fiber evidence linking Blair to the crime was legitimate. However, the one thing about the prosecution's case, which I did find a bit unethical, was placing so much emphasis on the clump of hairs found in Jack Carter Park and having experts testify that the hairs were consistent with Ashley and Blair. This location was 2 miles away from Carpenter Park, and since there was no evidence that either of them went to this park to begin with, the clump of hairs likely had no connection to the case. If this crime had taken place in the era before DNA testing, I don't think there's much chance Blair would have been exonerated, but DNA evidence doesn't lie. Even though the Collin County District Attorney's Office was initially reluctant to acknowledge that they may have convicted the wrong man, to their credit, they did finally change their tune once it became obvious that none of the forensic evidence matched Blair. I'm sure the knowledge that Blair was going to remain incarcerated for his other crimes made the decision to overturn his death sentence much easier. So if the killer wasn't Blair, then who really did abduct and murder Ashley? Well, ironically enough, Blair's defense team spent years pointing the finger at Josh Crowley, an alternate suspect who also turned out to be innocent. Again, I can totally see why people would think Crowley was capable of this crime. He had a previous history of child molestation and had fled to Texas from South Carolina to avoid those pending charges. And unlike Blair, Crowley could definitively be placed in Carpenter Park since he was refereeing the soccer games that day. Crowley was briefly questioned by police during the initial stages of the investigation, prompting him to immediately leave town, but as suspicious as that looked, I'm sure that was due to the fact that he was wanted on other charges in South Carolina. When questioned about his potential involvement in Ashley's murder, Crowley kept pleading the fifth, but when all was said and done, the DNA evidence did not match him either. Strangely enough, even though Crowley was not involved in Ashley's murder, his very presence in the park that day was another strong argument for Ashley's laws. Here was a wanted child molester who somehow managed to attain a job refereeing children's soccer games, so that was probably another sign that stronger measures needed to be taken. It now seems like authorities lean towards the real killer being a man known only as suspect number 4. But since this person has been deceased for 2 decades, they have elected not to publicly disclose his identity without conclusive evidence. I know that following Blair's exoneration, Barry Scheck was quoted as saying that the apparent real perpetrator had no record, though it's unclear if he was specifically referring to suspect number 4. If that's true, then this man obviously slipped through the cracks. There are definitely some things about him which look suspicious as hell, particularly how he made sure to get a burial plot as close as possible to Ashley's grave, and that he fabricated a story about having his own child abducted and murdered in a manner which was disturbingly similar to what happened to Ashley. All that being said, there have been a number of cases involving missing and murdered children in which a potential suspect popped up on the radar because they seemed to have a creepy obsession with the case, but then it turned out they had no involvement. In the aforementioned Michael Dunahy episode I just mentioned, I briefly discussed a person of interest who was obsessed with the disappearance of Jacob Wetterling, but years later, another suspect was charged with his abduction and murder. You could also apply the same logic to Michael Blair, because the only reason he even got implicated in Ashley's case to begin with was because he kept driving past the murder scene and seemed to have an obsession with her case. So even though suspect number 4 seemed to have his own unhealthy obsession with Ashley, that doesn't necessarily mean he killed her, and the physical evidence does not conclusively link him to the crime. The details about the DNA evidence are a bit confusing. It stated that suspect number 4 was excluded as the source of the DNA on the hairs found on Ashley's body and the skin underneath her fingernails, but could not be excluded as the source of the male DNA found in Ashley's shoes. We cannot even be 100% certain if the DNA on the shoes belonged to the killer, but since it was not consistent with Ashley's father or brother, there's a good chance it is the perpetrator's. But what's particularly interesting to me is that the DNA profiles for two separate males were apparently found on the skin under Ashley's fingernails. So does this mean that multiple people were responsible for Ashley's murder? This is what makes me ponder the possibility that suspect number 4 was involved in the crime, but had an unidentified accomplice who might still be out there somewhere. The best case scenario is that suspect number 4 committed the crime alone, since he's currently deceased, and cannot harm anyone else. There's a compelling circumstantial case against him, but it seems that with the evidence they have available, investigators cannot definitively prove or disprove that suspect number 4 is connected to the crime. But luckily, as I'm sure you're well aware, the new crime-fighting technique known as genetic genealogy has helped close the books on a number of cold cases this past year, and in some of these cases, the perpetrator was already dead, but genetic genealogy was able to link them to the crime and prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that they did it. So I think the best chance of providing full closure on Ashley's case would be to upload the DNA evidence they do have to a genealogy database and see if it leads to anyone. This could be the best strategy for figuring out whether or not suspect number 4 was involved in this crime, and if there may have been multiple perpetrators. But if this doesn't happen, the case could also potentially be solved if someone who knows something decides to come forward. So if you happen to have any information about the unsolved murder of Ashley Estelle, please contact the appropriate authorities. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email at robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. And one last thing. Only 2.5 years after Ashley's murder, another similar crime took place in Texas, which also led to the passing of new legislation named after the victim. On January 13, 1996, 9-year-old Amber Hagerman was abducted while she was out riding her bicycle, and her murdered body was found 4 days later. As you probably know, this crime led to the implementation of the Amber Alert program as a means of spreading the word about child abductions as quickly as possible. Amber's murder is still unsolved, and while there is no evidence to link this crime to Ashley's murder, the fact that it took place in Arlington, just over 40 miles away from Plano, has led to some speculation that the same perpetrator could have been responsible for killing both girls. Until these crimes are officially solved, the possibilities are endless. I would also like to recommend you check out the Gone Cold podcast, which is based out of Texas. In one of those odd coincidences that always seems to happen in the true crime podcasting world, they happened to release their own episode about the Ashley Estelle case a few weeks ago, just as I was finishing my own script for this episode. So be sure to check them out at GoneColdPodcast.com. Another reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/TheTrailWentCold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. We've already produced a bunch of exclusive bonus episodes for our patrons in Tiers 2 and 3, including an episode last month about the wrongful conviction of Johnny Lee Wilson, which was featured on Unsolved Mysteries. We've also recently implemented a new bonus reward for our patrons in Tier 3, in which I record my own audio commentary track to be played over episodes of Unsolved Mysteries, so to learn more information, feel free to visit our Patreon page. I'd also like to take a moment to thank our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Steve T, Jessica B, Kaylee B, and Alicia R. Thank you all so much for your support. I'd also like to take a few moments to remind you about some upcoming events I'll be appearing at over the next few months. You may have heard me recently announce that I'll be returning to Toronto this summer to participate in another true crime podcasting event. It will take place at the Royal Cinema on October the 18th from 2 p.m. until 5 p.m. In addition to myself, other podcasters who will be participating include Christy from Canadian True Crime, Jordan from the Nighttime Podcast, Nina from Already Gone, and Aaron from Generation Y. The event will include case presentations, panel discussions, an interactive Q&A, and a meet and greet. Tickets are $25 each, and you can find the link to the website to purchase them in our episode description. In addition, I will also be appearing at the True Crime Podcast Festival being held at the Marriott Downtown Hotel in Chicago on July the 13th. No less than a few dozen of your favorite true crime podcasters will be there, and I will once again be teaming up with Christy from Canadian True Crime to do a live show together in which we will be discussing some Canadian cases. So to learn more information about this event and to purchase tickets, feel free to visit their website at tcpf2019.com. And one more reminder that I will be appearing on Podcast Row at CrimeCon, being held at the Hilton Riverside Hotel in New Orleans from June 7th until the 9th. There are only a few weeks left to purchase tickets, but we have our own personalized promo code to get 10% off a standard badge. So to receive your 10% discount, please visit crimecon.com and enter the promo code COLD19. That's COLD19. I also just wanted to give another shout out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. Need to provide my thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play Music, or Spotify. So have yourself a good week, and join me next Wednesday for another new episode of The Trail Went Cold. Thank you.